Too old to wrangle the rat on the swing. You beat their triangle and you curse everything. Dirt was the kingdom, well, you'd be the king. On the good night trail, on the loving trail. The old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French are balls like a lost lowing calf. And it's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. With your snake oil and herbs in your liniments too, you can do anything that a doctor can do, except find a cure for your own goddamn stew. On the good night trail, on the loving trail. My old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harpet balls like a lost lowing calf. And it's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. Well, the cook fire's out and the coffee's all gone. The boys are all up and out raising the dawn. And you're still sitting there all lost in a song. On the good night trail, on the loving trail. I sharpie balls like a lost lowing calf. And it's a wonder the wind it don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. I know someday that I'll be just the same, wearing an apron instead of a name. Ain't no one can change it, ain't no one to blame. For the desert's a book written of lizards and sage. It's easy to feel like an old torn out page, all faded and cracked with the colors of age. On a good night trail, on the loving trail. Our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp balls like a lost lowing calf. And it's a wonder the wind it don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light.
We've been listening to one of New Mexico's greatest folk musicians, Claude Stevenson, perform the Goodnight Loving Trail. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. On Watersheds as Commons, we'll visit with ranchers who continue to raise cattle, but with a deep commitment to stewardship of the land. In the 19th century, as part of the wave of westward expansion invigorated by the concept of manifest destiny and the Homestead Act of 1862, Anglo entrepreneurs moved to the arid West and created vast cattle ranches. In part, they took their cue from Mexican ranchers who still held sway in parts of New Mexico and Arizona on land that until 1848 had been part of Mexico. They brought in larger breeds of cattle in great numbers, so that by around 1890, the southwestern landscape was heavily overgrazed and the cattle industry was facing disaster, as was the land. Sid Goodlow owns and runs a ranch in the Pecos River watershed of southeastern New Mexico. He's restored his ranch beautifully and is highly regarded as a forward-thinking cattleman who can raise cattle and steward the land at the same time. He has a finely honed historic perspective.
A woman from the University of Arizona named Sutherland did a paper on the Pioneers' journals. In those journals, they mentioned the fact that you could drive a wagon with the bows up and the sheet on the bows through this whole country and never hit a limb. And you could see for a long ways because the words they used was unencumbered by brush under the trees. Well, of course, you couldn't see 50 yards here because of all these young trees. So she got the dates on that, and that was in the late 1800s is when the first pioneers came through and wrote up their journals. And then she went into the weather, and she found out that there was a period between 1916 and 1920 that it rained every year really good. And all of the grass had been grazed off. There was no more fire because the massive movement of cattle came in here about the turn of the century or before. Nathan Sayer did a paper on the cattle boom in Arizona. The numbers there went from, in 1870, there was 40,000 head of cattle in southern Arizona, and in 1891, there was 1,500,000. Then the drought came in 92 and 93. Three quarters of them died, but they'd already done the damage. The land was raped, completely raped by too many sheep and too many cattle.
Bill McDonald is a rancher who lives in the Boot Heel of New Mexico and is a member of the Malpai Border Group of ranchers who have collaborated to engage in practices including long-term resting and restoration of pasture land and reintroducing fire into the environment. Their rangeland is becoming healthier and is a testament to the role of mutual cooperation within a community of practice. In many cases, their families have been here for generations, and they're doing everything in their power to keep from having to sell out to land developers who are only interested in turning this habitat into money.
Attitudes have changed involving ranching, both outside attitudes towards what you're doing and your own attitude about what you do. And certainly in the early eras, it was all about being a cowboy. I enjoyed, you know, breaking horses. I enjoyed all the challenges, the physical challenges, roping and herding large groups of cattle. And I even enjoyed fence building and horseshoeing and all the hard work. I took it as a personal challenge to try to master all those things. Had some rudimentary knowledge of range management, which I tried to employ, but I didn't look much past it as more than a cattle operation and a neat place to run cattle. I was annoyed initially by any suggestion that ranchers weren't just the greatest things on earth, that we could possibly be doing some harm to the environment. I thought was absurd, and I rejected it out of hand for some time. And it was only after realizing that there were some real consequences to continuing to ignore other people's concerns about what was going on that I began to open my mind up a little bit and realize there's an awful lot to running a ranch, being a cowboy, and that sort of thing, but there's more to it than that. You have to actually be a steward of that land, and you have to be concerned about everything that goes on that land, not just how the cattle are doing that day.
In the mid-19th century, Alan Savory, a biologist, farmer, and revolutionary from Zimbabwe, began to explore means of protecting rangeland from desertification, or more correctly, waste landification as the result of the presence of cattle. He gradually developed his theory of holistic management that has been adopted in various incarnations by many ranchers throughout the West. Sid Goodloe met Alan Savory over 40 years ago.
The old-timers, they're all gone that were here when I came here. They wouldn't admit that their forefathers had caused the problem. They wouldn't admit it. Now they're beginning to realize that, hey, they didn't do it on purpose. They just didn't know. And circumstances were against any kind of range management. And now, thanks to Alan Savory, we have a method to rotate these cattle, just like the buffalo rotated down through the plains and created the tall grass prairies and all those wonderful soils, because they rotated themselves because of the seasonal differences in growth on the plains. We can mimic that by rotating our cattle. And I ran into just lucky, ran into Alan Savory and Aubrey Mountain in Rhodesia back in the early 60s. When I moved to Kenya, I went back down there to check on it because I thought there was something really good about this deal. So I went back to Rhodesia twice while I was living in Kenya and talked to the ranchers that were using short-duration grazing. And Alan, he had his own plane. He flew me all around Rhodesia, and we looked at all these different ranches. And like if they had a five-wire fence, they'd take two wires off of the boundary fence to fence their pastures. They didn't have the money to buy the wire. Then they began short-duration grazing. Basically, it's a lot of cattle for a short period of time on an area with a long period of rest, long enough for the grasses to regenerate. I got all the information I could and went back to Kenya and wrote it up and sent it in to the Journal of Range Management. It was published in November of 1969. And I started getting letters from all over the world. People realized that this was a sensible, simple way to manage ranges. And so now it's evolved into holistic management, planned grazing, all these different things that Alan Savory brought to this country. And, you know, he did more for range management than all the range managers, professors, government employees, all put together in all the years behind him.
Tada Cruz grew up on a ranch near Bulleros, New Mexico, that had been in her family for generations. She and her husband Jack Cruz took over the ranch in 2001. Ute Creek, a tributary to the Canadian River, runs right through their ranch. Tada Cruz talks about restoration of Ute Creek.
Well, when we came back to the ranch, we inherited a ranch with four large pastures, and the creek was unfenced, and it was in a very degraded condition. The salt cedar plants, some of the trunks on these trees are, you know, 18, 20 inches around. This has been going on for 65, 70 years. And the brush was so thick, you couldn't ride a horse through it. If a cow got in that tamarisk, she was gone. I mean, there's no way you could go after her. And we knew this was one of the most critical issues. We forged partnerships with so many of these agencies, and New Mexico Game and Fish. I mean, it takes collaboration to deal with issues on this scale. I mean, this is huge. We planned our rotational grazing system basically off of fencing in Ute Creek. We're so fortunate to have Ute Creek running through 10 miles of our ranch. And Ute Creek is, of course, a tributary from the Canadian. When we came, the banks were so high and cut so deep, and there wasn't any water in the creek when we came. It had been an extended 12-year drought, and the ground just looked terrible. After we fenced off the entire creek, then we began addressing the issue of the salt cedar. So it took a whole season to do that work, and then the trees were left for 2 years to just rest and die off, and it made an enormous difference. That winter, we had water running down Ute Creek through 10 miles of our ranch. So our riparian area now is one of the most outstanding examples of restoration in the state. And it's been exciting, too, because wild turkeys have come back here. And my quail have come back. We have scale quail, and now we have Bob White, too. That has just been so satisfying for us.
Jack Cruz speaks of ranch practices they currently employ, including rotation of cattle through the pastures.
What we do a grazing plan, and we estimate the amount of forage that's on the ground and how long will that take our given number of cows. I just this morning moved cows from one pasture into another as part of the system. Those cows see an open gate, they just trail right on through and go to that fresh ground. They're well-trained. But by doing that, we're letting that ground have a chance to rest. And every pasture gets a minimum of 90 days rest during a growing season. So that not only that plant can grow and come to seed so that it can reseed itself, but more importantly, it lets that root system reestablish itself. Because that's how these plants get degraded so much, is that they use the food stored in the root system for the plant growth. And if this grass keeps getting bit off time and time again where it can't grow and do its thing of manufacturing food, that plant's going to die. And so our rotation system is geared around that process. And it's working very well. And when we came, the country was very denuded. It was coming right off of a multi-year drought. It looked awful. Cattle were in poor condition. The ground was awful. There was just intermittent ponds in the creek. So we had our work cut out for us, but we could see what we wanted to accomplish. And we weren't hamstrung with any of the old traditions. Like, well, we've always done it that way. So we were free to do what we wanted to do and not be constrained by tradition. And we were kind of criticized a few times and questioned about what in the world we thought we were doing. But we had a goal and a vision, and we had a lot of help. We established collaborative efforts like with the NRCS, Fish and Wildlife, New Mexico Water Board, range management experts like Kirk Gadzia, who's a protege of Alan Savory. So we had lots of help, and we launched into some new exciting projects that are really paying off for us now. We're pretty proud of what's happened.
Linda Davis runs a ranch south of Cimarron, New Mexico, that has been in the family for generations. It lies within the Canadian River watershed. Here, she tells of the annual cycle that takes place on her ranch in northeastern New Mexico.
Here, well, January, you're trying to break ice for the cattle so they can drink and feed them. If there's snow on the ground, you feed some hay. If not, you hope you have enough grass. Then in late March, you start calving, and you brand in June, and June, July, and August, the calves are growing, and if you're doing any pasturing in the higher country, you graze the higher elevations, usually from, say, the 1st of June into September, and then in September, you start gathering the calves up and weaning them, and if you're going to ship or if you're going to keep them over as yearlings, and then you get the cattle dispersed around. And we do sort of a rotational grazing, so we're always monitoring the pastures as they go. And then you go into your winter cycle.
Julia Stafford is the daughter of Linda Davis and works with her mother in the operation of their ranch. She also serves as a board member on the Interstate Stream Commission in New Mexico. How to think in terms of watersheds as commons, several generations after lands have been privatized under Anglo law, requires a great deal of mutual understanding and cooperation.
I started paying attention to New Mexico water law beyond our irrigation system in the 70s and 80s, when the lawsuit with Texas and very much coming into it from an almost an embattled point of view of, you know, they're out to steal our water kind of an approach. And over the years, as I've thought more about it, and definitely with the exposure that I've had on the commission, there is a much more productive approach to water management now that I think has come out of a very embattled situation. Almost anything that you decide in litigation is not well decided. And that's just the limitations of the judicial system, I think. I mean, that you can come up with such a better solution if everybody that's on the system is involved with the discussion. It's complicated because you have old rights and communities and businesses that depend on those. So, I mean, I think it has to be done with a lot of respect and sort of in historical context for those rights.
Many ranchers have had to sell out because of an economic paradigm that embraces land and housing development as a surer road to riches. Over the last century, the concept of best use of land has gradually shifted away from agriculture. One option available to ranch owners is the conservation easement, a perpetual legal agreement between the landowner and a governing agency or recognized land trust organization that restricts real estate development and other commercial uses that results in conservation of habitat, as well as a major tax break for the rancher. Sid Goodlow offers his opinion of the conservation easement concept.
Basically, what a conservation easement does, besides the tax benefits, it tells you what you can do with your property when you die rather than the IRS. Because if you die without any adjustment at all, Land values in New Mexico have tripled in the last 3 years. And so you're going to pay 55% of the value of your estate, which is the land valued at a development type appraisal, plus all your insurance policies, all your equipment, everything you own is totaled up, and you pay 55% within 9 months. That's the law. And so a conservation easement to me is a no-brainer. Cheryl and I did it in 04, 5 years ago on this ranch. If I die this year, no problem. So, but if I wait till next year, we go back to the 55%. Now, how in the hell are these kids going to pay that? And why would I be taxed after I die when I paid tax all my life? On everything I buy, I pay tax. Everything I sell, I pay tax. Or use it as a write-off for the ranch. I mean, gee whiz, that's the most unfair tax in the world, is an inheritance or death tax. All it is South American-style land reform without the guns. That's all it is.
In 1997, Sierra Club activists Courtney White and Barbara Johnson and rancher Jim Winder founded the Givira Coalition. Their original mission was to demonstrate that ecologically sensitive ranch management and economically robust ranches can be compatible. They termed this approach the New Ranch. Courtney White, author of Revolution on the Range, The Rise of a New Ranch in the American West, has been the executive director of the Givira Coalition since the very beginning. He has worked relentlessly to form common bonds between ranchers and environmentalists, and to evolve the practice of conservation and restoration across the landscape of the American Southwest and beyond.
How Givira has kind of changed over time, in the beginning it was built around some new ideas in land management, how cattle moved around, ideas of land health. There'd been a wonderful survey of land health principles that published by the National Academy of Sciences that we followed. It was actually real on the ground kinds of things. And then I met ranchers like Sid Goodlow and Julia Davis up at the CS Ranch. So as we began to work with landowners and looking at the grass and the soil and thinking about these things, I began to understand that we had some real environmental challenges in front of us that I didn't realize at the time, which was this land has been largely beat up over the decades. It wasn't until I met Bill Zeedike at a ranch in western New Mexico, at a project that we were doing out there, where I understood that the restoration challenges confronting us were just immense. So then linking good grazing practices to restoration and kind of a holistic vision was a natural evolution for the organization. So we began to work with Bill closely on a number of restoration projects. It's the same principles. Nature has the best idea, herbivory, the way creeks work, way we ought to be producing food off these landscapes, energy, things like that. So it kind of grew from peacemaking into sort of, land management practices, into this kind of vision of restoration, health, human health, land health, and then ultimately today to kind of confront what I call the age of consequences. In the 21st century, we have climate change, we have energy, we have food issues, all kind of staring us right in the face. And there are answers to these problems. They're largely found on the back 40 today. And that's where we're spending more of our time, looking on the back 40 for answers to problems.
Bill Zeedike is co-author of Let the Water Do the Work and a great innovator regarding habitat restoration. He is a pragmatist whose point of view is shaped in large measure by a lifetime of observation.
I guess I would summarize that most soil and water conservation, and therefore habitat conservation for wildlife, is understanding processes and the inevitable consequences of natural processes. And every time you alter one, there's consequences that you may or may not understand or foresee. But the fact that you didn't foresee them doesn't deny the reality of those consequences. So whatever you do or you don't do to a natural landscape, and however you justify it, has consequences. You can ignore the consequences, doesn't change them. If we set economic progress against a natural condition,
there's still consequences. We may need those economic goals to survive as the dominant species on the earth. I'm not assailing that, but it doesn't change the inevitability of the consequences resulting from the processes you set in motion. So to be honest, and to me objective, is to at least always try to list those consequences and be sure that they're worth the trade-off.
Drummond Hadley is a rancher poet who was instrumental in founding the Malpai Border Group in the Bootheel of New Mexico. He has vigorously sought to protect habitat from land developers and modern-day carpetbaggers. Here he reads his poem, Our Lands in the Belly of the Beast.
This poem is called Our Lands in the Belly of the Beast. Businessmen overheard in the Palm Court Restaurant, Plaza Hotel, New York City, America. Take them. Invite them out to lunch. Don't get attached. It's money. It's property. It's real estate. It's things. You say, do you want to sell it? What do you want to pay me to sell it for you? We made 50 or 60 million. He died penniless. His children ask us for $1,000 for the funeral. It was tax deductible. Of course, we gave it to them. Is it legal? The government pays lip service, but the competition is fierce. You will have no license. You will be seen as a mortgage consultant, a foreigner. Your English will not be like theirs. The property will be worth more than 8 to 10 times what we pay for it. You will ask them for 3 or 4, but before they know it, you will get 10 million. When I am going to foreclose, I pay the lawyers maybe 50,000. 4%, 3%, 5%. The poor man never wants to pay the lawyers, so you know the poor man will lose. These companies are like candy stores. Make all the dough you can. Buy today. Sell 'em short. Take them. Invite them out to lunch. Subdivisions in mountain valleys, wild running rivers, country ways of livelihood. Deer, cowboys, mountain lions, javelina. Don't get attached. It's money. It's property. It's real estate. It's things. Take them. Invite them out to lunch.
On Watersheds is Commons, we've heard from Claude Stevenson, Sid Goodloe, Bill McDonald, Tutta and Jack Cruz, Linda Davis, Julia Stafford, Bill Zedike, Courtney White, and Drum Hadley. Theme music was provided by Carl Bernstein. Production of Watersheds as Commons is funded by the Christensen Fund and the New Mexico Humanities Council and is produced in the studios of the Leffler Oral History Archive. For free access to other Lore of the Land programming, including our earlier radio series, Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, please visit our website at www.loreoftheland.org. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.